And the portion of God's Word we're looking at together this morning is Isaiah, as usual, and it's chapter 41 that we find ourselves in this morning. And I encourage you to find on the back of your bulletin a sermon outline that will help you to keep track of where we go as we plow through chapter 41 and make it well on into chapter 42, as previously announced. And if this is new to you, or if you would appreciate the reminder nonetheless, let me remind you of what happened last week when we looked at chapter 40. We looked at chapter 40, at words of comfort that God gave to his people through the prophet Isaiah, long before they needed it. But he saw where they were going. He, in fact, was leading them through history. He saw them coming into a period, it would be 100 years after Isaiah, where they would be in deep need of comfort. And so he spoke words of comfort to them. It's called chapter 40 of Isaiah. Starts out with the word comfort. Words of comfort delivered long before they were needed, so that God's people would have it, have them when they needed them. And in the process of seeing chapter 40, we saw, here's a single sentence summary of chapter 40 on the sermon outline. Our great God calls the people who really know him to show him off to the world. That's our calling. We call it, we refer to it as making known the greatness of God, but here it is in chapter 40 with different words. Verse 9, get yourself up on a high mountain, bearer of good news. Lift up your voice mightily, bearer of good news. Lift it up, don't fear. Say to the cities, here is your God. And there is the people of God getting their assignment. The people who really know God are called to show him off to the world. And in the process of showing him off to the world, taking on the assignment to which they've been called, they are offered a wonderful gift. It's the gift of strength, the very gift that they need if they're going to do what God is calling them to do. And you see that in chapter 40, verse 31. Those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength. Well, the same theme continues this morning in particular. So the sermon is entitled Strength and Help, and we're going to explore together how it is and the context in which God gives strength and help to those who ask for it. And in actual fact, we'll see that he doesn't give strength and help to everyone who asks, but only those who ask in a certain way, only those who ask for a certain purpose. But I hope you're right with me on this. Many of you would be, because your life is reminding you on one or many fronts that you are a person in need of strength and help. Sometimes we get oblivious to that. Sometimes we think that we can do quite fine, thank you, without any sort of outside interference. But when we're taking full stock of our responsibilities and know how complicated a thing it is to live life well, we are reminded of the fact that we need outside strength and help. And some of you don't need me to tell you that, but some of you do, because you're stuck in a point of life where you don't see that to do what God is really calling you to do requires an outside source of strength and help, and God means to be that strength and help. I get like that sometimes. I get pretty complacent, happy about the way I'm managing everything, and I plow along for a while until reality sets in, and I realize again that if I'm going to achieve excellence and do well at the things that God is calling me to do, I'm going to need to be continually receiving strength from him. And what reminded me of that this week was the fact that I am the happy father of three teenagers, although one has graduated from teen to 20, and they're all here right now, so they're listening carefully to see what happens next. What I discovered this week, and this is a conversation that Debbie and I had at the breakfast table Friday morning when Jesse was off at work and Ben and Joanna were off at high school, so there we were. Preview of empty nest syndrome. We had breakfast alone together on a Friday morning, and we got talking about the week. And I found myself observing, it's a lot of work being parents to teenagers. And Debbie quickly agreed, and we reflected on the fact that it's a lot of work. And we're halfway through the exciting experience of having teenagers. We've had teenagers in the house now for 7 years, and we will continue to, Lord willing, for 6 more years. So we're in year 7 of a 12-year privilege. So we're halfway through, and I know about half of what I'm going to learn by experience. I'm half experienced in it. And here's the startling thing I've learned. I know a number of you are raising little kids right now, and you're looking at us and seeing how bad it's going to get. With great personal interest. Here's what I've learned about raising teenagers so far. Two things that I want to pass on to you as an illustration of our need for strength and help. But your life illustrates the same thing. Let me talk personally for a minute. I have learned that there's nothing particular about being a parent of teenagers that naturally and spontaneously knits you together with the teenagers. That being the parent of teenagers or being teenagers with parents doesn't naturally glue you together so that there's some sort of guarantee that when your kids cease being teenagers, they will be more tight-knit to you, closer to you, more intimately acquainted with you than they were when they started. In actual fact, all the natural forces, I think, work in the opposite direction. So that if you just kind of plow through without a lot of concentrated effort Your kids will not be as close to you when they're 20 as they were when they were 12. And they may not have been very close to you at 12. But that's because the experience of getting them to teen years has the same effect. But there will be, through all of the complicated challenges of being good parents and being good teenagers together, there will be so many differences coming up, so many challenges, so many complications to the relationship, that if you're not very, very, very careful, you will grow apart. And some would say, well, that's just the natural impulse. Of course you're going to grow apart, because they're going to leave you. They're going to fly the nest. And that's true. We intend for them to fly the nest. But our plan, and I'm sure the plan of every parent of teenagers here, is that when they fly the nest, they come back a lot because you're their friends. And the experience of being teenagers in your house has not so alarmed them that they lose any interest in seeing you again. I mean, this would be, you know, heartbreak for us. So we're working away, sometimes very sloppily and ineffectively, at maintaining the closeness that we had with them before they were teenagers, and in fact enhancing it. And it's not a natural thing at all. It's a lot of work. That's one thing I've learned. Another thing that Debbie and I have learned, and this is even more alarming because before we had kids we were a young married couple, what we've learned too is that there's nothing particular about raising teenagers, parenting teenagers, that binds a man and a woman together. That is, we start at a certain level of closeness and intimacy, and the whole experience of having teenagers now for 12 years doesn't knit us together. In fact, it in some ways articulates our differences and threatens to drive us apart. And that would be a bad thing, because eventually they are going to leave us, and then we're together alone. And if we're strangers at the breakfast table 7 years from now when the grand enterprise is over, it will be a tragedy, but not a rare tragedy. So if we want to stay close to each other, I mean, it just happens naturally, right? Even as little tykes, children learn the knack of playing parents off against each other. Even if they don't mean to, they do. And they just get better at it as teenagers, as you know, as they approach adulthood and develop a whole set of values which collide with one parent's values more than the other sometime. And then, you know, they see that, they don't miss that. And it can be a wedge that drives the spouses apart. And Debbie and I are committed to that not happening. But the natural forces are for it to happen. That we offend each other by the way we think differently about what our kids are up to and into and so on. And my heart goes out to people whose teenagers are giving them a real rough ride, because I don't think mine are. But they're being teenagers, and they're trying to adjust to having parents still trying to parent them while they're trying to be adults who don't need parents. And it's a complicated bit of business. And it's a ton of work. That's what we noticed Friday morning at breakfast. It's a ton of work. And work requires strength. So I am a man in constant need of some strength beyond my ability. And I'm not even going to talk to you about what's involved in being the pastor of a church, but there's some parallels. To be a good pastor requires a constant source of strength beyond my ability. To be a father, to be a mother, similarly. And some of you are right there with us. You're raising teenagers as well. And some of you have already done that, and you're trying to recover from the experience. And some of you have little children, and you're looking forward, naively, you're looking forward to the time when they'll be teenagers. And I'll tell you, it can be just as much fun and more as when they're little, but it's more work, I think. Or at least it's a very different sort of work. But I'm not so old to forget how much work it is to have little kids in the house. That's a ton of work, too. And if you don't have children and have a different calling, or don't have a husband or wife and have a different calling entirely, life is a ton of work. There's just a lot to do if we're going to do it well. Limping through is a lot of work. Excelling is even more. So we're all in need of a constant source of strength and help. And good news, that's exactly what God offers us. And we'll see that in chapter 41. And I hope you see really clearly how relevant this is to the life you're living. Because God has called you to live a certain sort of life. It's not easy. It's hard. It's not simple. It's complicated. It's probably going to get more complicated before it gets more simple. You'll need more help and more strength later than you need now. So we ought to get expert on this, on the sort of strength and help that God supplies. Let's look into God's Word and see what He can tell us about this. Chapter 41, verses 1 to 7 is the first section. And let me summarize the first part of this first section, verses 1 to 7, with a note to write down. God's intention is to be known and praised throughout the entire world. God's intention is to be known and praised throughout the entire world. You see that in the first few verses. He calls the world to attention. Coastlands, he says in verse 1, listen to me in silence and let the peoples gain new strength. He calls people to come to him and to receive strength from him. And then, I'll leave the details for another week when it's even more clear. He talks about the things that he himself, that God is doing in the world to make a point that commands their attention. And so he summarized that in verse 4. He says, who has, he means himself, I have, in fact, God has performed and accomplished, calling forth the generations from the beginning. God says, I, the Lord, am the first, and with the last, I am he. And here, among other places, you see God stating his intention to be known by the coastlands, to be known by all the people in the world, and to be praised by all the people in the world. That's God's intention, that the whole world has, that he has the attention of the whole world, and the whole world's focused on him. That's his intention, to be known and praised throughout the whole world. And I'm really chatty this morning and going on a mile a minute. I have to do it again. You'll wonder if I ever get settled into the text, but I just have to say about that, that you'd be misunderstanding God and human history significantly if you saw something amiss in God's intention to be known and praised in the world. It can sound to people, on first rush especially, as sort of a selfish, indecent thing, that God is sort of showing up and saying, hey, pay attention to me. I mean, we despise other people doing that. How can we tolerate God doing that? Well, here's the deal. God has not just shown up. He's not a God from somewhere outside, and he pops down to planet Earth, where people are minding their own business, living their own lives, and says, I'd like attention. It's God's world. We only got here because God made us, and he made us for a specific purpose, and the purpose has everything to do with knowing and praising him. We've been made in the image of God. We've been made like mirrors to reflect the image of God, to reflect the glory of God. And the only way we can do that is by focusing our attention upon him. We've got to look straight at him as mirrors to get the image of God in us. And if we turn away from God, we cease to be what we're created to be. So God is not like anyone else who would say, pay attention to me. He is God saying, be what I have created you to be. That is the image of God, the reflection of the glory of God in the world. So he's simply calling us to be what we're created to be. And all of us have an inborn desire for happiness and peace and joy and love. And what you need to understand is that all of that comes as the plain consequence of getting right this big assignment of being the image of God. The joy and the peace and the love and the purpose all come to us as we focus on God, as we get the mirror looking at God. And then his glory reflects in us and builds in us like fruit. Love and joy and peace and long-suffering. That's the fruit. That's the consequence of focusing on God. So God is not doing you a disservice when he says, I want you to know me and praise me. He would be doing a disservice to do anything else, to allow you to just wander off and live for some piddly thing when you've been created for this great and magnificent thing of being the reflection of the glory of God in the world. So all of that need to be said to understand that God's intention is to be known and praised throughout the entire world, and it's a good intention. It's part of his love for us that that he calls us to align ourselves with the design of the universe for which we've been created. And then we get to verses 5 to 7 and find this bad news. God's intention is to be known and praised throughout the world, but he's not. His intention is to be known and praised throughout the world, but he's not. He's not known and he's not praised. And you see that in verses 5 to 7. The coastlands who have been called to God have seen and are afraid. That is, seen and are afraid of what God is doing in the world. He is at work in the world, bringing in kings, raising up empires, dashing down empires. The coastlands see it all happening and they're afraid. The ends of the earth tremble. They've drawn near and have come. Just as they've been called to come together to see God, they do come together in fear. But what do they come together to do? Verse 6, each one helps his neighbor. That sounds good, but it's actually bad. Each one says to his brother, be strong, which sounds like a good thing to say, but it's a bad thing to say. Why? Because of what they're helping each other and strengthening each other to do. Look at verse 7. So the craftsman encourages the smelter, and he who smooths metal with the hammer encourages him who beats the anvil, saying of the soldering, it's good, and he fastens it with nails that it should not totter. And that may sound innocent enough. Okay, so some workmen are working together and they're saying, hey, it's good work, and be strong and be encouraged. But if you read on, you'll find out, I need to give you the preview here, they're building an idol. They're building a false god. So they see what God is doing in the world, they sense the need for strength and help, and they build themselves an idol to receive the strength and help from a false god, and they encourage one another along. They say, be strong, be encouraged, keep going, hey, nice work. They're building an idol. They're not knowing God, and they're not praising God. They're sensing the need, which is a need for God, but they're misunderstanding it or ignoring the understanding of it, and they're getting on with the work of ignoring God and satisfying their need for a focus by building themselves an idol. So what does God do about that? Well, he would be entirely within the realm of justice to simply wipe the whole human race out and say it's all gone bad, let's start again. But he doesn't do that. He does something else, which we read in verse 8. But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I've chosen, descendant of Abraham, my friend, you, whom I've taken from the ends of the earth and called from its remotest parts and said to you, you are my servant. I have chosen you and not rejected you. Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely I will help you. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Behold, all those who are angered at you will be shamed and dishonored. Those who contend with you will be as nothing and will perish. You'll seek those who quarrel with you but will not find them. Those who war with you will be as nothing and non-existent. For I am the Lord your God who upholds your right hand, who says to you, do not fear, I will help you. Do not fear, you worm, Jacob, you men of Israel. I will help you. I will help you, declares the Lord, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. It would have been appropriate for him, considering the whole world's gone bad, to give up the whole thing as a mess, like a potter who makes a jar and it goes wrong, so he breaks it and starts over again. But God doesn't do that. Instead, he offers his servant strength and help. You can write that in. He offers his servant strength and help. While the whole world is ignoring him, he turns his attention to this one particular group of people that is referred to as my servant and identified later on in verse 14 as the men of Israel, that is the whole nation of Israel, and he offers them strength and help. You might know this verse from a wall plaque near you. Do not fear, I am with you. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely I will help you. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. He offers them strength and help. But here the context is everything. This is not a universal, one-size-fits-all offer of strength and help to any old person who may have any old need for any sort of help. It's a specific offer to his people, and even there it's not made universally, so his people get all the strength and help they need to do anything. But it's his offer to his people to do one thing, and that is to be involved in his intention of making him known and praised throughout the whole world. And this is a really important distinction to make in regard to the nature of the help and the strength that God offers. Because all kinds of experiences show us how much we need strength and help. And God has an infinite supply of strength and help to offer it. But he offers it to us on a condition. And the condition is that we will use that strength and help to do that which he has called us to do. To do that which he's called us to do. Think about Philippians 4:13, another wall plaque near you. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Who says that? The Apostle Paul, who in the same letter to the Philippians has already said, whether I'm in prison or whether I'm free, whether I live or whether I die, as long as Christ is proclaimed, I will rejoice, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. And it's he who says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. It means the person who's committed to living for Christ so that to live is Christ and to die is gain, and he'll rejoice that Christ is proclaimed regardless of his circumstances. He's the one who will be helped to do all things. That is, all the things that he's called to do as a person who lives for Christ. So living for God, signing on to God's program, is the great proviso. It's the great condition upon which all the strength and help is offered. So it's a total misunderstanding to say, you know, I'll do this and I'll do that and I'll do this and I'll do that because I've got all these ideas and all these dreams and God's always there to strengthen me. He's only there to strengthen you as you do what he's calling you to do, which might be as nitty-gritty, real, ordinary life as seeing teenagers through their teenage years or being a teenager and coping with the ups and downs of having parents trying to do you good, or whatever your challenge and rigor is. If you're doing it for the Lord, if you're signed on as a person who lives for Christ, then strength and help is infinitely available to you, but only as you continue to use the strength and help to do the work he's calling you to do. This becomes obvious as we read on. What does he say to this nation of people, the nation of Israel, that he offers to help? He says, behold, verse 15, behold, I've made you a new sharp threshing sledge with double edges. You'll thresh the mountains and pulverize them and make the hills like chaff. What's all that about? We'll see verse 20. That they may see and recognize and consider and gain insight as well that the hand of the Lord has done this and the Holy One of Israel has created it. This all fits in with what chapter 40 talked about as a throwing down of the mountains and a filling in of the valleys. Remember that? God is asking for a highway to be made. A highway to Zion. He's asking for us to have a part in making it possible for people to get from the wilderness in which they live to the city of God, that is, to God. And in order to get from the wilderness to the city of God, many mountains need to be thrown down and many valleys need to be filled in. This is metaphoric language, right? This is not civil engineering. This is the work of the gospel. This is making a road through the wilderness as a way of saying making it possible for people to get to God. And so he says to Jacob, his servant, that is, he says to the nation of Israel, you're actually just a worm, but I will help you, I will strengthen you, I will make you a new sharp threshing sledge with double edges so you'll thresh the mountains, so you'll plow the mountains. You're just a little worm capable perhaps of making a little hole by eating the dirt, but I will make you into a sled. I will make you into a sharp threshing sledge with double edges that will plow the mountains, so as to make it possible for people all over the world to travel the highway of holiness to the city of God, that is, to the presence of God. So he offers his servant strength and help and decrees that they will make him known and praised throughout the whole world. He refers to his people as the servant for a reason we'll see, but it's not just one servant, it's the whole nation of servants, it's the nation of Israel, and he decrees that they will make him known and praised throughout the whole world. That's what's to make of all that threshing and pulverizing stuff. Decrees that they, the nation, will make him known and praised throughout the entire world. So you see the goodness of God. He means to be known and praised. The whole world yawns and looks the other way, gets busy tacking together some idols so that they can worship without worshiping God. He could have blotted us all out, but instead he raises up a nation of Israel to be his servant. And he says, now you get busy communicating my greatness to the world so that I will be the world. This he does for the benefit of the world and for the fulfillment of the design of the universe. And so then you say, so how's it going? How has Israel been doing in the days of Isaiah and immediately before? How's it going? And the answer is it's not going well at all. For verses 21 to 29 show us, fill it in, that the world remains more impressed with idols. The world remains more impressed with idols than they are with God. If they know anything about God, it doesn't move them to change. They remain more concerned of and committed to idols. So he summons, as he summoned the nations at the first part of the chapter, now he summons the idols together. And he calls them. Let them bring forth and declare to us what's going to take place. Go ahead and forecast the future, you idols. Tell us what's going to happen. Or for that matter, as for the former events, declare what they were. Tell us the past. Do something to show that you are gods, he says. And of course, they can't because they're not. They're just pieces of metal hammered together as tacky substitutes for the living God who calls us to radiate his knowledge and his glory throughout the world. So the whole thing's a dismal failure. The nation of Israel fails in bringing the attention of the world to him. So what does he do? Well, he who refused to wipe out the world but instead raised up Israel refuses to cancel the project just because Israel fails. So what does he do instead? Well, he takes that great nation that was his servant, that great nation of Israel, all the descendants of Abraham, and he carries it forward in the future. And in a sense, as it's carried forward in the future, it's getting bigger and bigger. But in a sense, as it's carried forward in the future, it's getting more and more focused until finally it all comes down. The whole history of the nation of Israel focuses down to a place called Bethlehem and to a young woman who miraculously is giving birth to a child. And she gives birth to the child, and it is Jesus, and he is the ultimate seed of Abraham. He's the ultimate descendant of Jacob. He's the ultimate servant. So what we have in chapter 42 is God repeating what he's done for Israel, but now doing it to one particular descendant of Abraham, speaking of Christ himself, and says in chapter 42, "Behold my servant, whom I uphold." My servant used to refer to the whole nation, now it refers to one particular descendant of Abraham, one particular Jew named Jesus Christ. My servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights, I've put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. Now that's the particular wording by which Isaiah describes the work of Christ. And it's not wording we would normally choose, but let's be enriched and expanded by this. When we talk about the coming of Christ into the world, we'd normally say he came into the world to offer forgiveness, or he came into the world to give us life and life more abundant. And as long as we're quoting the Bible in context, we're saying what's right. But it's interesting and important to see that Isaiah doesn't talk about the assignment that way. He talks about the assignment as bringing forth justice to the nations. And what you need to see is that Isaiah says it differently because Isaiah is entirely God-centered. He sees the whole world ignoring God, the whole world of people created for God ignoring God. And he sees the injustice of that. People created to be like mirrors reflecting the image of God, turning away to reflect the image of any number of other things. That's unjust. God's glory is being transgressed. It's an unjust thing. He wants the mirror turned back so people will focus upon God and begin to do what they've been created to do. And Christ comes into the world to bring forth that sort of justice to the nations. And we would normally think if a whole world's going to be changed in its focus, that there would be a revolution, that there would be some sort of uprising, that there would perhaps be a clash of weapons and a great deal of bloodshed and so on. And here the prophet Isaiah explains that this bringing forth of justice will not be that sort of violent, disruptive revolution at all. He'll not cry out or raise his voice, nor make his voice heard in the street. Not only will he not go to war, he won't even raise his voice. A bruised reed he will not break. He'll not only not take a sword and clash with the armies of the world, but he won't even break off a weed, a plant that's got a bruise. And a dimly burning wick he'll not extinguish. Comes across a candle that's just about out, he won't blow it out. He won't do anything violent at all. But he will faithfully bring forth justice. And he won't quit. He'll not be disheartened or crushed until he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands will wait expectantly for his law. When Matthew, who wrote a gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, when Matthew, who wrote a gospel, spoke about what Jesus of Nazareth was doing, you can read it for yourself in chapter 12, he quoted this passage because he saw in the benevolent work of Jesus Christ, raising the dead and cleansing lepers and healing the sick, he saw Jesus doing the very thing that he was called upon to do. He came into the world to establish justice. He came into the world to correct the injustice of people living for anything else other than God. And we read on about this great God who would be so kind to us. And we read, "Thus says God the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and its offspring, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk in it. I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I will also hold you by the hand and watch over you, and I will appoint you as a covenant to the people." This is God the Father talking to God the Son about what God the Son will do as the servant, the seed of Abraham. He says, "I am the Lord. I've called you in righteousness. I'll hold you by the hand and watch over you, and I'll appoint you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the nations, to open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the dungeon, and those who dwell in darkness from the prison. I am the Lord, that is my name. I'll not give my glory to another, nor my praise to graven images. Behold, the former things have come to pass. Now I declare new things. Before they spring forth, I proclaim them to you." And what we're being told here is God's marvelous solution to the problem of hanging in with a world that insists on disobeying and solving the problem the way he did. He raises up a nation and they fail in their attempt to bring the whole world's attention to him. So rather than giving up on the project, he comes down into the world in the form of his son, in the form of Jesus, and he does it himself. And in doing so, it's doing the work himself, he maintains the central purpose of the assignment, which was to capture the attention of the people and focus their attention upon him and cause them to praise him alone. If he had used anyone else other than Jesus, if he'd raised up some other great person other than the great person who is Jesus, then he would have shared his glory, the glory of getting the work done, with someone else. And the whole thing is about not sharing his glory, but capturing the attention of the people and focusing their attention upon his glory. So he comes himself, and he heaps upon Christ all the help and all the authority he requires to accomplish the purpose of bringing people all over the world into a focus, into an attention upon him. But when he has Jesus do the assignment, he doesn't give his glory to another because Jesus is God. And so the glory is not shared because he gives the glory to Jesus, the glory of the job to Jesus, and Jesus and God are one. So we see here a bold statement about the nature of the servant, what he will do. He'll establish justice. He'll correct the injustice. He'll bring people to God. And the fact that in doing so, he doesn't in any way rob God of his glory because he is God in his glory. And I've given you some New Testament references to reinforce all that thought. So here's the deal. We live our lives and find our lives a lot of work. And if our lives don't seem a lot of work, then I'd say to you, hey, get to work. If you're going to do what you're called to do well, it's supposed to be a lot of work. If it's a walk in the park, I'd say, get out of the park. Get to work to be excellent parents or an excellent single adult or an excellent young teenager learning to become an adult. What God has called you to do is a lot of work, and you're going to need a lot of strength and a lot of help. Well, no problem. God has a lot of strength and a lot of help to offer you. And what you need to do is simply learn to look to God for that, and every day, in every way, always be drawing down from God the strength and help to cope, the strength and help to be tough, the strength and help to be soft, to be forgiving, to be tough, to be whatever you need to be. And God will offer you that strength and help and continually supply you that strength and help on one condition. And the condition is that you'll sign on to his program and not take the strength and help he gives you and use it to get off topic, but to stay on topic, which is to do everything to make known the greatness of God and to see God praised. So if you're at home raising children, you raise them to love God. And if you don't have children, then you're free to do something else to make known the greatness of God. And if you're a child yourself, you're called to grow up to become an adult who knows how to serve God as an adult because you've learned how to serve God as a child. And as long as you sign on to the program, you will never lack the strength to cope and to do more than cope, to conquer. And to do more than conquer, to overwhelmingly conquer, because that's the guarantee. Nothing will separate us from the love of Christ as we are the called according to his purpose. So it all boils down, all of this talk about strength and help boils down to a question, which I am now to ask you. Here it is. The question is, I ask it on God's behalf, do you want in? Do you want in on the program which defines the universe? There's a program going on. There's many programs going on. There's people trying to get rich. There's people trying to give some help to people. There's people trying to have fun. There's lots of programs. But there's one program which defines the universe. It's God's program to bring the nations, to bring the world to know and praise him. And God says, now, do you want in? Do you want to have a part in it? It might mean no change to your current responsibilities. It might be that you're right in the right place. You're running a business, or you're teaching a class at school, or you're in between jobs and looking for new work to the glory of God. I mean, it might be that you don't do anything new. You just do it all for this one purpose of bringing attention to the glory of God. Do you want in? And if you do, then have I got good news for you. If you want in and get in to the purpose, if you live your life for Christ and for what he came to do, establishing this sense of justice in the world, if you come into God's program, then you will never lack strength and you will never be helpless again. Because you have immediate access to infinite strength and ongoing infinite help. You'll always have the strength and you always have the help you need to do whatever God calls you to do, as long as you're doing it because God has called you to do it. And as you do sign on, and as you do take part, not only do you have the great pleasure of seeing that your life is not being dwindled away, but rather being invested in the one thing for which the whole universe is about, so you have a meaningful life with all the benefits that come from that, the joy and the peace and so on. But besides that, you have a part in making this world a decent place to live, a right place to live, a place in which more and more people are coming to know and praise the God who created the world to know and praise him. So it's not only a matter of getting into something meaningful, it's getting into the single most meaningful aspect of all of human history. So the question is, do you want in? And if you do, tell God about it. That would be the application. If you do, sign on, sign up, enlist yourself. Say to God in your own heart as he hears your thoughts, say to God, yes, I want in. I want to live my life for nothing short of, nothing less than the purpose for which I was created, which is the purpose for which the whole universe exists, that is the purpose of bringing the world to see that our God, our great, great God, is worthy of praise and glory, worthy of praise and adoration. You can get in. The door is wide open. anyone's allowed to apply for a position and is given a position, which may mean a major disruption in your life and may not. But once you get settled in, there may be things to straighten out. I may be of some help to you. We could talk about this sometime. Once you get settled into your calling and understand what God is calling you to be for now, if you do it for the glory of God, if you do it to make His greatness known, you'll never be weak, you'll always be strong, because when we are weak, then we are strong, because He strengthens us. You'll never be helpless, you'll always be helped, because He helps the helpless. And this is a great way to live. This is a way that allows you to rejoice and smile, even in the most difficult complications of life. And life is difficult and complicated for anyone who takes it all seriously. So I call you to come in. Can't think of a reason why you wouldn't. I need to say to those of you who wouldn't, well, you don't want in on the thing for which you've been created? May God help you. And I say it like that because there's no assurance that He will. May God help you. I hope God will help you. But of course, I'm hoping that He'll help you reverse your plan and you turn back to Him. For that's what you've been created for, to focus on Him, to reflect His image to the world, to help the world come to see that He is a great and glorious God.